The lecture yesterday was fairly technical, where we've seen a very explicit example of quantization of tetrahedral network with a flatness constraints. So let's start with a Norman gauge invariant tetrahedral spin network, which is given by this expression. And this corresponds to the following picture. Okay, and we've seen that this intertwiner forms a representation of J1 plus J2 plus J3 into the trivial representation. Now we can see here that we have four loops. The first one is okay. Now we consider the holonomy around a small closed curve. So we have the holonomy of curve gamma given by plus order of three. Now, when we impose the flatness constraint, we basically set this term to be zero. So we're left with just one. Now, when we impose this on the loops we have there, we have that the given state, psi, is given in terms of the delta functions. Which result in the holonomy's identity. Now, when we impose the integral version of the Bianchi identity, we have in terms of this two equals 1. Now let's say that we have, if you recall, when we have two kinematical states, psi 1 and psi 2, just with the Gauss constraints and no flatness, they're given the physical, and this is going to be equal to the following kinematical state. Now, when we take the physical inner product, we get the following state for the tetrahedron. Okay, now we want to find out the transition amplitude between the planar spin networks, which mean the networks that we can write on the two-sphere after we triangulate. So okay. So the conclusion is that we have one independent physical state in one-dimensional Hilbert space. Which gives the following physical state. I So this is our conclusion.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, so indeed yesterday we finally, so we really, from the beginning of this course, we started from the first order action for 3D gravity, and then we did all the steps of the Dirac quantization, and the last step was to find the physical Hilbert space. And so it's what we did today by implementing the last constraint at the quantum level, so the flatness constraint. But of course, you need to specify now what is your 2D hypersurface. And we have chosen here the simplest case where it's a spherical 2D hypersurface. Okay, we looked at the two sphere, then we took the one graph on this sphere, and we look at what was the physical state, and there is a unique up to normalization. There is one physical state given, so here it's not completely finished. Then if you compute this, what you get is this sig J symbol up to normalization, okay? Which, and this indeed is what we were expecting. This reflects indeed that we don't have any on the two sphere, so it's a the topology is trivial, so you don't expect any degrees of freedom, so we have a unique physical state here, okay? Okay, so this was the 3D case. So tomorrow, Eugene will do a small recap on the 3D approach as a summary. So hopefully things will be clear, because I know that each step was quite technical, so you can get lost between all these small details and everything, but at least you have seen that you can really do all the calculation. And what is important is that now I'm going to talk about the 4D case, and many things are quite similar, okay? So of course we don't have completely the dynamics, but many of the variables, many of the tools that we have used here could be used in the case of 4D gravity. So if we were starting like in the, so let's look at 4D case now. Like the first order action, we would use the Palatini action, which in 4D is given by, of course, you have some parameter here, and M is your manifold, and now it's quadratic in the, what is a tetrad now, because I can take, and J can take the value from 1 to 4 or 0 to 3, depending. And here is this action as an addition, a Lorentz invariant, okay? So depending if you're looking at the Euclidean case, it's going to be SO4, or if it's a Lorentzian case, then it's SO31. But in fact, everything, as I told you, the 4D case is very similar to the 3D case. And indeed, it's also going to be written in terms of SU2 gauge theory. So from this action, if we were starting from this action, since we have a Lorentz here invariance, to get to SU2, we need to do, it's going to be partial, of course, because we keep some gauge fixing. It's the time gauge, usually it's called. And then you would go to SU2. So historically, this is not the starting point of, and in most of the literature, you don't find the what I call the Hashteker-Barbero variable, which are given by the densitized triad and a connection, a SU2 connection, you don't find starting from this action. And so I'm not going to develop so much this approach, but you can indeed start from this formulation and do this gauge fixing and then define the Hashteker-Barbero variable. But historically, when Hashteker introduced, introduced its variable, one canonical formulation of GR was already there, and it was the ADM formalism, okay? So this, the first, and it started from that. So the first canonical formulation of GR is in terms of the ADM variables. And so what are the ADM variables? So the starting point here, because it's really just doing a canonical transformation that then the Hashteker variable were introduced. So you start from, again, now from the metric, using the metric variable, so the Einstein-Hilbert variable, where you use the metric, and then you do a 3+1 splitting of space-time. Is the usual canonical approach, so which allows us to identify a function of time parameter. So we have a space-like hyperfunction now. And the phase space, so we will have a lapse function, a shift vector, but the phase space variable are given by phase space. Now, the spatial metric, So the degrees of freedom are still encoded in the metric. So you have the spatial metric. That usually is denoted on the surface. So here you do a 3 plus 1 splitting, so you have a surface time R. Okay. So on this surface, and of course the canonical, the conjugated momenta, which is given. So usually we use this notation, and you get it just using the usual definition. And this is related to the extrinsic curvature of your 3D hypersurface here. And then you have constraint. Of course, it's still a constraint, a totally constrained system. So you have the vector constraint, which is, or the space diffeomorphism constraint. So it's space diffeo. And you have the scalar constraint, and then so we generate this, the time evolution. So this is usually we call that the scalar constraint, and then you can the space-time differ are generated by these two constraints. Okay, and again the Hamiltonian is going to be a linear combination of constraints which are first class, so it's exactly similar. But now, what is the issue here to apply the Dirac program to this system? Okay, so here you have a system where the dynamics is given by this Hamiltonian, which is a linear combination of constraints. So it's exactly what we had in the 3D case. So what is the issue here? Why people were stuck at this level is to apply here the Dirac's quantization framework, h mu is a very complicated function. In particular, it's non-polynomial function of the variable, so qab and so these two functions, the space-time function. And so it's really too complicated to quantize. So people tried, but then there are many anomalies. So what was the what makes things work is then when Hashtekar by Hashtekar he made a change of variable. And what was this change of variables? And you will see that with this change of variable, everything is going to look very similar to what we did in 3D because it's a triad formulation now. Why it's a triad formulation? It's because it's a special metric which is going to be written, so it's going to introduce a triad on this 3D hypersurface, okay? So indeed, it's exactly the same variable we had in 3D now, except that, of course, it's not describing the GMU new metric, it's just describing the metric on this special hypersurface, and you have exactly the same. And again, when you introduce this small frame at each point of your hypersurface, you introduce an additional degree of freedom, which is a rotation, okay? At each point of your hypersurface, now you have this small frame, so you can rotate it. And it's, again, a SU2 gauge symmetry. So here we have additional degrees of freedom. And we get the SU2 gauge symmetry. So it's really the same. We are adding the same symmetry. And then, so what are the variables we have? So we're going to define a densitized triad. I'm not going to redo everything. I'm just going to give you what are the variables. A, J, K, and this is what we denote Okay, so this is our first variable, and then the other variable is what we call the Hdkar-Barbero connection, and it's a SU2 connection. And now the difference with Hdkar-Barbero connection, which is a SU2 connection, and now the difference with 3D is that we have a class of connection. Okay, we don't have unique one, and in fact, so this is the Levi-Civitas connection, okay, the usual one you know from GR, and then we have this Emirzi parameter here, gamma, times the intrinsic, so this is the extrinsic, so. The curvature. So which is a one form. Okay, so I'm not going to, so this is what we call the Emirzi parameter. I already mentioned this parameter in, I think in my introduction. And also, so when Eugenio talked about black holes, when Aurélien talked about the LQC approach, okay, as soon as it's in 4D, you have this parameter entering, and in particular, it's going to, for example, to be the area of a black hole is going to be given in terms of this Emirzi parameter. Also, the area spectrum now in 4D is going to be proportional to this Emirzi parameter. And so at the classical level, all the theories are going to be equivalent, okay? You don't see any difference, but at the quantum level, it's more subtle, and it seems that since it appears in the geometric operator, that we have to define what is really the meaning of this variable. And so there are many discussions on this parameter, because so initially, originally, in the first formulation, this was just equal to I, so it was an imaginary number. And now, since it's, but when it's imaginary, this is not a SU2 connection, it's still a SL2C connection. So you're working with a non-compact group, and you need to add some reality condition and stuff like this, so things are more complicated. So then now we are working in with gamma is a real number. Okay, of course, it's G with, we try to avoid the zero value. And in this case, then this is a SU2 connection, but there are some issue with this connection. Okay, this connection cannot be obtained as a pullback to sigma of a space-time connection. So yeah, people are trying to see if it's really, so it's still, yeah, this parameter is still under discussion, trying to understand what is the meaning, if we really need to take a real parameter, if we should go back to this initial formulation with an I, where then you're talking about the cell dual formulation, okay? But I'm not going to give too much detail here. You can, if you're interested, I can give you some references. But then, so these variables are conjugated variables, so you have this Poisson bracket.
One question.
Yeah.
Parameter could be constrained in principle by experiments?
Or yeah, so this now is one suggestion, that is that since it's appearing in some geometric operator, if we can make prediction, usually some prediction are going to depend on this parameter. So the question is it going to be fixed or not? Or yeah.
Could it be a running kind
yeah.
of like?
So all these are option that for the moment, yeah, it's still, we don't know, but it's. Yeah.
So you mentioned that when we have gamma equal to I,
yeah.
We need the compatibility condition?
Some reality condition.
Reality
okay.
Condition.
Yeah.
And what is that?
So this reality condition, I think, so it's just to, because we want at the end something, so this is then complex, and then the theory or the action, everything has to be real, so you need to have this kind of, you have some addition constraint, and I think the difficulty with this constraint, I'm not 100% sure, is that there are second-class constraints. So this means that at the quantum level, it's always complicated to deal with second-class constraints. So that's why also this theory, in addition to deal with a non-compact group, I think the constraint are also the structure of the algebra is more complicated, constraint algebra. But yeah, again, if you want to talk about that, yeah, Mark or Wolfgang, I think Wolfgang worked a lot on this self-dual formulation. So you can, you should ask him. Okay, so the conjugated variable, meaning, yeah, that, but now you have this gamma parameter here, the only change. Sorry, I put two. Here, I. And then we have some first class constraint. What are these constraints? So you have the Gauss constraint, and then we are left with these two constraints, except that they're written in terms of the densitized triad and the connection. So Gauss constraint. And then you have this vectorial constraint, and again, this scalar constraint. So just to mention, so in 3D, we had this Gauss constraint and the flatness constraint. But if you, of course, the flatness constraint could be decomposed in terms of spatial diffeo and time evolution, okay? And if you look at the article I gave you for the second homework, okay, in this article, this decomposition is made explicitly. It's just that at some point I wanted to ask you to check this calculation, but it seems that there is a sign mistake in it. And you will see that in the calculation I ask you to check explicitly, there is also another issue. So I was, okay, I'm giving you an article which has been already reviewed by people, and the only two calculations I'm going to ask you, there is a mistake. So I was feeling a bit, maybe it's not a good example, so I didn't ask you finally to check. But if you're interested, you can just look how this calculation is made. So in the 3D case, the flatness constraint can really be decomposed this way, and then you really have the same kind of formulation. So then, of course, what was the next step when we had this constraint? What did we do in 3D? Did we work directly with the constraint written in terms of this variable?
No. Like.
Yeah, but even before defining this variable, we worked with smearing, yeah, smeared constraint. Okay, so then the next step is to do the smearing here.
One question.
Yeah.
So this gamma doesn't have units, right?
No.
And so in the action, it appears as a. So one gets like 1 over gamma E times A dot, right?
Yeah.
So this Poisson bracket, maybe it shouldn't have the gamma, or like, is that a postulate?
Yeah, then it's, you don't have to factorize by the gamma. So if you write the gamma in front of your action.
Like, one usually, like the Poisson brackets, one defines for the canonical variables, and then, I don't know if you choose that constant over there, is by choice, or is it like how?
Yeah, it depends how you, the way you normalize more or less your, well, it's not really normalized, but you write your action depending on the parameter you. But usually, if you just do, if you start really with the ADM variable, so if you write this action with the ADM variable and then you make this change of variable, then you will have the gamma appearing, and then automatically in the bracket you have this gamma here. Okay. But since we don't know what is this parameter, we could do also another choice, start with the action we start with. But this parameter really appear here when we make this change of variable. So if you just do that, really starting from this section, then automatically you have it in the Poisson bracket here. Okay, so once we have done the smearing of the constraint, then we get the constraint algebra. So I'm going to write, it because I want to point out what makes things a bit more complicated than in 3D. So of course, if you have two Gauss constraints, so it's two rotations, so at the end you get also a rotation, a Gauss constraint. So this is similar to what we had in 3D. Then you need to look at the Gauss constraint with the vectorial constraint. And here, this is going to give you Gauss constraint with this value. So then the Gauss constraint with the scalar constraint is equal to 0. And then you have this and the last one, which is the one which makes things complicated, is the scalar constraint with itself. And here you get something like this, plus some terms proportional to the Gauss constraint. And here the point is that this field D it's a field dependent structure function. So even if here you see that I told you that usually we are saying that an algebra is said closed when you compute this Poisson bracket, it's always proportional to another constraint. So here it's more or less the case, but because of this, it's not really closing in what we call the BRS sense. And this is the reason why we don't have a proper representation of this algebra. So this proper representation of this algebra is still missing, and indeed it's come from this complicated here term. Because of course here you will have, this is a function also of the inverse of the metric, and thus in general even it's going to be a non-polynomial function of basic variables. So as soon as you have something non-polynomial to quantize that, it's complicated.
Is this the person in the more modern Lawrence?
Yeah, because then you get exactly the same thing. It's just the starting point is a bit different, because here you start from a tetrad and etc. So you don't have to, it's already there if you start from this action. But at the end you end up with the same variable. So here the only thing which is different is really the starting point. But as soon as you are dealing with this variable, it's the same starting from here to here, okay? It's just another way to get to this variable, okay? Because here it's really already with this splitting, so you do this. Okay, so then this is the classical, now we can apply to this system the Dirac's program, okay? This is the idea of loop quantum gravity, again, is to apply the Dirac's program. And so what do we get? So it's going to be the definition The first step, of course, is the definition of the kinematical Hilbert space. And this is very similar to what we get. It's identical even to the 3D case. So I'm just going to review that quickly. But it's going to. So, of course, as you mentioned, Monica, we are going to introduce holonomies now. So, we have variable, we want to smear them. So, again, A is a SU2 connection, it's like one form, so we are going to smear that on one curve. So, we're going to get one dimensional object. So, we're going to get holonomies on graph. And then what are going to be state or function, again, we are going to consider. So if you just consider one edge, okay, then it's function of the group, it's function of this holonomy. But if now we consider a complete graph, okay, we talk about cylindrical, like yesterday, I introduced yesterday, I think, function of generalized connection . So these are your state in your kinematical Hilbert space, okay? And then we need a measure. So if you're just dealing with one edge, again, it's going to be the R measure, okay? But now if you deal with graph, this measure, well, it's very related to the R measure, but it's called the Hashtagger. Hashtagger Lewandowski measure, and where you have, so usually we denote it like this. If you consider a function, so a cylindrical function, so which is defined in terms of a graph and a smooth function, then this is just given by the integral over SU2 times the number of edges you have. Okay, and here you have the product of R measure, where E are the edges of your graph with your smooth function here. And we can define, on this space of function, we can define an inner product, which is just given by, if you consider two cylindrical functions for two graphs, F1, and then on the graph here, it's your function, so that you can also see that as of the connection . And then really a technical part is to get really your kinematical Hilbert space is just the space you take the space of cylindrical function using this Hdkar-Lewandowski measure, and you take the Cauchy completion. Okay, so this is a bit technical. I'm just giving you this result. I'm not going to give you more detail. So this means that this is the Cauchy completion of the space of cylindrical function in so function that I did not seal in this Hdkar-Lewandowski measure. Okay, so then, and then of course we can define, let's write it here, sorry, it's a bit, we need to define the orthonormal basis, and this again is going to be given by matrix for each edge, matrix element of SU2, okay, so you, and you can still write your edges this way. And then, of course, I didn't mention here, so I just mentioned the connection. So what about the triad now? How are you? Are we going to smear it? Yeah. Yeah, okay, so now each edge, you're in 3D. So each edge, the dual is going to be a surface, okay. And so I'm not going to give you here the complete definition, I will. And I will mention it a bit later when I'm going to mention the area operator. But so now E is a two form, so it's going to be smeared in on this surface. Okay. But it's not, no, the density slide is not a two form. We can make it a two form by contracting with this epsilon ABC, then you get a two form. Okay. Okay, so this is the kinematical hyperspace. So then what do we need to do? It's to impose the constraint. So which one can we impose? Of course, the Gauss constraint, we can impose it, and the result is going to be very close to what we have in 3D, but it's going to be the same. So let's maybe move that. So if now we impose the Gauss constraint, I'm not going to redo everything, but what you get is that what we call the fundamental excitation, you can see, of space. So it's your the basis, orthonormal basis of usually, we still call that the kinematical Hilbert space, even if we already impose this constraint on now the spin network. Okay, so this is the same. And what is a spin network? Again, it's the same as in 3D. It's going to be a decorated graph where on each edges you have SU2 spin representation, an irreducible representation of SU2, and each vertices is going to be labeled by E, an intertwiner, so which is an invariant tensor in the tensor product of all the SU2 irreducible representation on this vertex. Okay. And the spin network state, they form a complete basis of the Hilbert space of solution of the Gauss, of the quantum Gauss law. Okay? So here, they form a complete basis of Hilbert space of solution of the quantum Gauss law. So the connection, so now let's, and what are the geometrical interpretation? Here, so let's look at the area operator. So again, I remind, so the connection here has been smeared over a 1D submanifold. So the you expect that the densitized spheres are going to be smeared over a 2D, okay, a surface. And here, indeed, so let's look at function of the triad now. It's what we need to define the area. We want to define the area operator to find a kind of interpretation of this object. So function of the triad. So we are going to look at this object, which is now a two-form and can be smeared over the 2D surface, okay? So in a similar way that we define the length operator in 3D, now we can define the area operator, okay? And using this, we can define the area of this 2D surface. And the action of this area operator is diagonalized by the spin network state, okay? So this means that the spin network state are eigenstate. So if here is the area of this surface, let's say S here, and this is a spin network. State. Then you get, if I am in this situation where I only have one puncture here, then otherwise you need to, it's just very similar, but you need to add for each puncture. So now you have this gamma appearing here, but it's still discrete, and it's still written in the term of this SU2 irreducible representation. So you still have a discrete spectrum here. And then another important result of 4D gravity, loop quantum gravity, is that we have a quantization of the volume operator. And so here, yeah, this is for a single, so this result is for a single puncture. And what is the picture that we have now? So what we're going to get for the volume operator is also that we get a discrete spectrum, okay? And so the property of this area and volume operators provide a very simple geometrical interpretation. So now each edge of your spin network is going to carry a quanta of area, while the volume is a quantum number can be used at each node of your spin network. Okay, so let's maybe try to do another drawing. Which one? So now we have again this graph. Okay, and each edge is characterized, and each vertex node is characterized by this intertwiner, and this characterizes area. Okay. And here you have the, so for each edge, you have like this an area. So I don't know. You have a 2D surface. And then it's closing, and the volume inside this surface is characterized by a quantum number, which is also given in terms of this intertwiner. Okay? So the drawing is not very, but you close this, and you get this volume. So what is really important, and maybe it's going to go back to your previous question on what are these graphs, okay? So the embedding or the coordinate system that we choose here, okay, to draw the speed network graph does not carry any physical information, okay? What is really all the information about the degrees of freedom of geometry here, because we are talking about the gravitational field, okay? So the gravitational field is the geometry of space-time, is just contained in this combinatorial aspect of the graph. What is connected to what? And you see that these two nodes are connected with this edge. This is going to mean that these two nodes is two volume, is two volume connected together. And the fact that they are connected together with this edge is going to give you what is the area separating these two volumes. Okay? So really here, all the information, you don't care about where your graph is, what is the system of coordinate that you use to draw your graph. What is important is really the connection of this graph and the combinatorial information that you have that is really giving you all the information you need about the geometry. And here you get the quanta of area, quanta of volume, and this gives you how the graph is connected, how the volume of space are connected together, and what is the area between them. So then the next step is, of course, to implement. So here we just look at the Gauss constraint. So the next step is to look at the special Diffeo constraint. Okay? So we want to implement. So the next step in the Dirac program is now the special Diffeo, and this we know how to. So this means we want to implement something like this. We want to have an operator and now acting on our spin network state because we already implement the Gauss constraint. We want to find solution of this equation. And a similar method to as for the Gauss constraint can be more or less used, but again here be careful because we will have non-compact gauge orbit. It's really similar to, in fact, the flatness constraint we have in 3D, okay, this one. And here we have a natural basis for that, which are called, so this constraint has been solved. And the natural basis we get are what we call the S naught. So I give you the name, and then I'm going to try to explain what this means, or abstract. In case you found that spin network were not abstract enough, okay? Now it's abstract spin network, so we add a new layer of abstraction. Spin network states. So what is the S naught here? So S naught is an equivalent class. Equivalence class S of embedded spin network under the action of Diffeo, so the special Diffeo. The Diffeo that we can denote like this on this 3D space. So what does it mean here? This means that now if you get two spin networks, they belong to this equivalence class. If you can find a Diffeo which relate them. So what is this abstract graph now? S naught is really characterized by what we call an abstract graph, meaning just defined only by agency relations, okay, between links and naught. So and by the coloring and by is noting and linking properties. So So as in not property, not theory. Okay, so what does it mean? To be more explicit, so if we now have, so we still know how many loops, for example, in the graph, wind around, so if we have a manifold with a hole, we will still know how many loops we will have, okay? Our edges are going to intersect each other. This is still kept. But where the graph sits inside the manifold, or its location and its metric properties, so the length of, so your graph, if you really said, okay, I'm going to, the classical length here that you get, this property are completely forgotten. So this means that now if you can go from one graph to another by deforming it or moving it just using a DFAO, okay, you consider that these two graphs are carry the same information, okay, are the same, give you the same information over space-time. So each S naught now here defines so a gauge in and DFAO invariance state of the gravitational field. So what is now the picture that you have? So the picture that you have is that since S naught is purely algebraic, okay, it's a algebraic kinematical quantum state of the gravitational fields. And now each link of the graph can be seen as carrying a quanta of area. Each node can be seen as carrying a quanta of volume. And so S naught can be really seen as an elementary quantum excitation of space formed by chunks of space that you glue, that are glued together, okay? So here, the chunk of space are these nodes that are quantized, and the area between them is also a quantized version, and it's characterized by this edge here, okay? So this is the picture that we have. So usually in gravity, we're just working with the spin network. We don't really go directly to this S naught, but this means that this constraint has been solved. So now, what is the last step of the Dirac program? The last step would be, of course, to implement the scalar constraint now, okay? And this, of course, we don't have the answer here, okay? So the issue now, the Hamiltonian constraint is still an open problem. So there are several approaches that have been developed. So one of them is what is called the master constraint approach. So by Thomas Thiemann, but also Bianca Dietrich and everything. So nowadays it's a bit less studied. And the other one, of course, is the spin foam approach, where we try to find, define a path integral approach and try to implement the dynamics of the spin network state using the path integral approach. So this is what I'm going to tell you tomorrow. And yeah, just a last thing. So with this S naught is, so they do not live on a manifold, okay? Because now these are what define where by itself, because it's space. It's at least space, not space-time yet, but it's space, okay? So you cannot really say, you cannot ask the question, where is this graph or on the position of this graph, because it's defined really space itself, okay? It's not something living on space.